Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 217 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the Family Medicine Shelf Review Series. Like I said, it's going to ultimately be very comprehensive, but for now, I'm going to focus on the highest yield topics. I know I've talked about GI, so now I'm going to talk about POM, right? Because, you know, all the COPD, asthma, and all that stuff, it's kind of high yield to know for your exam. So the thing is, you don't need to know like as much about pulmonary physiology for the shelf as you needed to know for step one of the medicine shelf, but you know, you still need to know some things, right? So don't forget your spirometry values, right? I mean, for the most part, if for example you're trying to diagnose someone with asthma, with COPD, or any of those obstructive restrictive lung diseases, the prudent thing usually you would want to start with on an exam is spirometry, right? And we know, like, you know, the classically described FEV1 to FVC ratios. If the FEV1 to FVC ratio is less than 0.7 on your test, the person has some kind of obstructive lung disease, right? And then if they tell you that, oh, you know what, after they give a bronchodilator, a person's FEV1 or FVC increases by like 12%, right? Or by more than like 200 mils, like 200 cc's. Then that person essentially has like some kind of reversible airway obstruction. In this case, we're probably looking at asthma, right? And then if the FEV1 to FVC ratio is like normal or mildly increased, usually greater than 0.8, you know, you want to think about restrictive lung disease under those circumstances. And in general, right, don't forget, right, like obstructive lung disease in general tends to have increased lung volumes, but restrictive lung disease in general tends to have increased lung volumes. Restrictive lung disease tends to have reduced. So remember the R's match. So restrictive lung disease, reduced lung volumes, right? And don't forget like this thing called DLCO. DLCO just basically is a measure of how good your liver is, not liver, your lungs are, at how good your lungs are at allowing oxygen to diffuse, right? So if you have like a diffusion problem, right, that will cause a decrease the DLCO, right? So for example, they love to make up questions where they talk about like obstructive disease or restrictive disease, and you then have to pick them out by, oh, which one has a normal DLCO, which one has a decreased DLCO, right? So for example, if you think about it, if a person has a like restrictive disease and they tell you that, oh, this person's DLCO is decreased, right? You want to think about things that are intraparenchymal, right? You want to think about like pulmonary fibrosis, right? Or if a person has some kind of pneumoconiosis and whatnot, right? Those would be causes of restrictive disease with decreased DLCO. And the reason the DLCO is decreased, right? If you remember from step one, right? The diffusion equation for the lungs, right, is directly proportional to area available for diffusion and inversely proportional to the thickness of the membrane, right? So think about it. If a person has pulmonary fibrosis, the lung parenchyma is super thick, like the diffusion membrane is super thick, right? So because the thickness is going up, the diffusibility will be going down, right? So that's actually the mechanism of hypoxemia in a person that has pulmonary fibrosis, right? And that will be associated with decreased DLCO, right? But if they give you an example of restrictive disease and you're like, this person's DLCO is normal in the question, then you want to think more along the lines of a person having like some kind of neuromuscular disease, right? So say, for example, a person has like Guillain-Barré syndrome, or a person has myasthenia gravis, or a person has ALS, or a person has, you know, any of those neuromuscular things that can make essentially the diaphragm not work as well as it should, right? Because there's nothing wrong with the alveolar membrane. It's the mechanics it's the mechanics of the lungs that are screwed up, not the actual lung parenchyma. So even obesity, right? Because again, if your abdominal cavity, remember, like your body is like kind of like a fixed space. If if the abdominal cavity is too big, right, because the person is obese, then the pulmonary cavity will not be able to distend as much as it should. That will cause restrictive lung disease. If a person has like some kind of anatomic problem, right, like kyphosis, scoliosis, pectus excavatum, right, they can have restrictive lung disease for those reasons, right? So again, those are just things to keep in mind. Like, but those will be examples of restrictive lung disease with those would be examples of restrictive lung disease with a normal DLCO, right? And then if we're going into the realm of obstructive disease, right? Again, think about emphysema, right? In emphysema, you're literally having all those proteases just chew up your alveolar membranes, right? So you have a decreased surface area for diffusion, right? So if you decrease the surface area, right, then you're going to have less diffusibility. So emphysema is one of those classic MBM exam causes of obstructive lung disease with a decreased DLCO, right? But consider other things like bronchiectasis, for example, right? Like bronchiectasis, right? Like it's the lung parenchyma is not really that screwed up. It's the actual bronchi, right? So the thing is, that'll be an example of obstructive lung disease, but with a normal DLCO. I know you may say, Devon, you're kind of harping on this DLCO crap like a lot. I promise you, it's kind of high. It's not kind of high yield. It is high yield to know. And you may think, oh, family medicine shelf can never test these. Well, thankfully, I actually have experience tutoring a ton of people for said shelf. So, well, believe whatever you want. Okay. And then this one is probably more so step two, but I'll just throw it in since I'm talking about DLCO. If you see a person that has increased DLCO, they want to think about people that have like polycythemia or they have like blood in the lungs, right? Like they have like pulmonary hemorrhage, for example. The mechanisms behind that, I'm not necessarily going to talk about those because they're kind of low yield. If you're interested, just email me. I'll be happy to explain to you, right? And then some other things with this, all this pulmonary testing, I think I should kind of mention is if a person has like carbon monoxide poisoning, right? Or a person has like cyanide poisoning, right? It would make sense that, cyanide and carbon monoxide, the primary problems they cause is that they bind to hemoglobin and kind of screw up its oxygen carrying capacity, right? So the thing is the PaO2, right? The partial pressure of oxygen is completely fine, right? So if you do pulse oximetry, it will actually be normal. In people that have like cyanide poisoning or carbon monoxide poisoning, it's the SaO2 that is abnormal, like the actual saturation of oxygen on hemoglobin that's all screwed up in a person that has a cyanide poisoning. So just one of those cyanide or carbon monoxide poisoning. So just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So don't be fooled by a normal pulse oximetry. In fact, if you suspect that a person has a carbon monoxide poisoning, instead of doing pulse oximetry, do co-oximetry, right? Or you measure the levels of carboxyhemoglobin, whatever, right? And then one other test you may see, right, is this methacholine challenge test, right? The methacholine challenge test essentially is a test where, you're like, this person, I think you've got asthma. Your dose spirometry is stone cold normal. You're like, but you know what? I'm not really buying it. I still think you have asthma. You give those people methacholine, right? Methacholine is a muscarinic receptor agonist. So technically, it's supposed to cause like bronchospasm, right? So if you give a very dilute amount to normal people, it won't cause any problems. But if a person has like touchy airways, right? Like, hyper-responsive airways, they will have like a decrease in the FEV1. So whenever you see stuff like that, right, think about asthma. If a person has a positive methacholine challenge test. So again, don't forget that pulse oximetry business with cyanide poisoning and carbon monoxide poisoning. So let's kind of talk about asthma, right? So the thing is, asthma on MBM exams, they may give you a person that wheezes at night. They may give you a person that, has cough. That seems to be worse at night. Or they may give you a person that has a lot of like nasal polyps. Nasal polyps tends to have like this big association with like aspirin or other NSAIDs, right? So like there's this thing called aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, right? Basically, if you see a person that has asthma and nasal polyposis, you want to consider making that diagnosis. And you may say, oh, fine, what's the mechanism behind that? Well, if you think about it, if you remember back to step one, membrane phospholipids, you can convert them with phospholipase A2 to arachidonic acid. And then that arachidonic acid can go down the prostaglandin pathway with COX or can go down the leukotriene pathway with LOX, right? Lipoxygenase. So the thing is, if you take aspirin or an NSAID and inhibit COX, well, when COX is inhibited, then you have increased flux through the LOX pathway and you produce a ton of leukotrienes, right? That can begin to cause problems, right? Because leukotrienes, they can increase vascular permeability and all that stuff. They can cause bronchospasm. So all those things can potentially cause symptoms of asthma, right? And usually that kind of asthma tends to respond extremely well to leukotriene inhibitors, right? So like those leukotriene receptor antagonists. Remember, the leukotriene receptor is the CYSLT1 receptor. So drugs like montelukast and zafirlukast, right? They work pretty well. Although remember, montelukast is preferred over zafirlukast because it has fewer side effects. And then there's also this like oxygenase inhibitor like Xylutan. Again, that's kind of hepatotoxic. So usually montelukast will be the right thing you should select on your test, all right? So asthma, again, like I said, if a person has normal spirometry, doesn't mean they don't have asthma, right? You need to, your next step in diagnosis on the test will be to consider getting a methacholine challenger testing, which I already explained already, right? Now, one thing I just want to say, since we're kind of talking about asthma, if they give you a question about a person that, and usually whenever a person has asthma, they'll have like a storied family history of like all these allergic problems, right? That happens in like 90% of MBME questions that detail asthma. But another thing to keep in mind is if they give you a question about a person that seems to have like asthma, and you're like, man, this person also has like some kidney squibbles going on, right? And they tell you that the PNK is increased. You want to think about Churg's traps, right? Like EGPA. EGPA stands for eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? And then if they give you a question about a person that seems to have like these chronic asthma-style symptoms, and you're like, man, this person's IgE is like crazy high, and they may tell you that, oh, this person has a history of like past TB, or this person has like you see like infiltrates in the upper lobes of the lungs. Think about like allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, right? Allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. In general, you just do like some skin testing for aspergillosis to establish the diagnosis. Now, asthma, right? The thing is asthma, you need to be able to classify asthma on your test, right? And there are four rungs on the ladder of asthma, right? And I know that people find this kind of hard to remember. So to be honest with you, here's how I learned this thing. There are essentially four rungs in the ladder. And the smart thing to do is to learn the ends of the ladder, right? And then the stuff in the middle, you can usually like decipher what it is on the test, right? So for the most part, the least severe form of asthma is like mild intermittent asthma, right? So they have symptoms less than like twice a week or less. Let me put it that way, twice a week or less, right? So they have symptoms like daytime symptoms like twice a week or less. They may have nighttime symptoms twice a month or less, right? So just remember twice for mild intermittent asthma, right? And these people, you just give them a SABA, that's it, right? SABA, so like albuterol, stuff like that, right? And then the most severe is these people have just daily continuous symptoms. They can't do any physical activity because of the asthma. That's severe persistent asthma. I'll say that again. That's severe persistent asthma. Those people need to be placed on oral corticosteroids, right? They need to be placed on oral corticosteroids. And then in the middle on MBME exams, right? You know, we have like mild persistent. Basically, mild persistent is just, they will typically in the question tell you that, oh, this person has been placed on a SABA and their symptoms are not very well controlled, right? Then you just go ahead and add an inhaled corticosteroid, like a low dose inhaled corticosteroid, right? And then if, for example, a person is having symptoms like, you know, they're taking like a SABA and they're taking like an inhaled low dose corticosteroid and it's not really cutting it, then you go ahead and add a LABA. That's the third rung in the ladder, right? And then obviously if a LABA is not working, right, then you go to like oral steroids, right? And I'll say some things about oral steroids that your friends at the MBME can integrate with other concepts on an exam, right? So again, mild intermittent, again, symptoms, daytime symptoms, you know, twice or less per week, twice or less per month for nighttime symptoms. Mild persistent is the second rung in the ladder. They have symptoms more than twice a week, right? Or more than twice a month for the nighttime symptoms. Severe persistent is just, again, they have symptoms all the time. That's the fourth rung in the ladder. The third rung is just they have symptoms almost every day of the week, right? That's just, again, rough ideas, but I feel like if you kind of remember these rough things I'm giving you, you should be able to answer like 99% of the questions you've seen. To be honest with you, I've never truly set out on exams to like, oh, I gotta memorize this, these are asthma guideline, like, oh, mild this, mild that. I've just never found it to be helpful on exams. And I've taken many exams where this concept has been tested. Just remember the rungs in the ladder. You start with a SABA, like albuterol. If that's not cutting it, you add a low-dose inhaled corticosteroid. If that's not cutting it, you add a LABA. Although instead of adding, let's say you don't see a LABA as an answer choice for the third rung in the ladder, you can consider adding like a medium dose of an inhaled corticosteroid. That's fine. Or you can add like a leukotriene antagonist. That's another thing you can consider. And then again, the fourth rung on the ladder, like severe persistent, you again add oral steroids, right? So again, don't forget, there's mild intermittent, mild persistent, moderate persistent, and severe persistent. Basically, I just remember the three M's and then the S. And the only one that has intermittent in it is the first one. So mild intermittent, then mild persistent, then moderate persistent, and then severe persistent. And they all go in alphabetical order, right? Like mild intermittent, that's an M and an I, right? And then mild persistent is an M and a P. Yes, moderate persistent is also an M and a P. But if you look at the word mild, M-I, I comes before O in the alphabet, moderate, right? And then severe persistent, S is much later than M in the alphabet, right? So everything follows alphabetical order. So it should be said pretty much from that perspective, right? And then, you know, the rungs on the ladder are kind of different for COPD. So COPD, you start with like a SABA or a, like a SABA or go on, and I'll talk about this in a bit. But you know, like SABA SAMA for COPD, and then after that you add a LABA. That's the second rung on the ladder, and then the third thing is you then add the inhaled corticosteroid and then oral steroids as the fourth rung on the ladder for COPD. So there's kind of a difference there compared to asthma, right? And again, remember certain drugs that can trigger asthma symptoms on exams, right? Like a non-selective beta blocker or even a beta blocker, because they can give you a question about a person that has asthma and glaucoma, and maybe they start treatment for glaucoma and then the asthma gets worse. Because remember, you can give beta blockers for glaucoma, right? So, you know, don't give those things to people that have asthma. That's probably not a prudent idea. Because again, there's a reason we give beta agonists for asthma. So if you're giving a beta blocker, you're like saying, oh, you know what, let's cause some more bronchospasm, right? You don't want to do that to your patients. That's probably like, you know, like ill-advised, right? So you don't want to do that. So if you really need to use beta blockers in a person with asthma, you know, try to avoid it. But if you can't, you know, use the selective beta blockers, like those that go from letters A through M, right? Like atenolol, metoprolol, stuff like that, right? And again, remember aspirin-induced asthma, NSAID-induced asthma, stuff like that. I already explained the mechanisms behind those and how leukotriene receptor blockers are probably pretty good for those people like montelukast, right? And then if they give you like a weird, bizarre question about a person that has asthma and they have like very high IgE levels, you can, and they say, oh, which of the following medications is shown to decrease the incidence of attacks, you can give them like a drug that especially if they have like very high IgE, you can give them like anti-IgE preventive meds like omalizumab, right? Omalizumab is a monoclonal antibody against IgE, right? And then one other thing you want to keep in mind is people that have asthma, because your the family medicine shelf has a big preventive medicine component, you want to remember that those people should get the annual flu vaccines, right? And they also actually are one of those people that the pneumococcal vaccine is relevant for, right? And then they may also just ask you like all these weird questions where the person's asthma symptoms are not well controlled because they're not using their inhalers properly, right? Or if a person is taking like an inhaled corticosteroid and they start having like dysphagia or like odynophagia, you want to think about thrush, like candida esophagitis, right? Especially again, if a person is using inhaled corticosteroids, you tell them to like drink water or something, right? So that they can kind of like decrease the contact time between the inhaled corticosteroids and the esophagus, right? And the thing is, if a person is on chronic steroids, right, for like asthma, you want to put them on like PPIs, right, like prophylactic PPIs, because steroids can cause a peptic ulcer disease. And you also want to put them on like prophylactic like bisphosphonates or like calcium vitamin D supplementation, because remember, corticosteroids can cause osteoporosis, right? Again, these are all things to keep in mind for tests. And then sometimes on the family medicine shelf, they love to ask about like some drug interactions, right? So the first one is, remember, you cannot give a LABA like salmeterol formoterol as like singular therapy in asthma, like monotherapy. That actually increases morbidity and mortality. So you want to avoid that. And then fluoroquinolones and or like macrolides, those drugs, because remember, one of the drugs you can use to treat like asthma or even really bad COPD is theophylline, although I'll say also asthma. So the thing is, theophylline has a ton of drug interactions, right? So the thing is, if they give you a question about a person that, you know, comes in for a COPD, like an asthma or COPD exacerbation, and they're on theophylline at home, right? Remember, when people have like asthma or COPD exacerbations, and let's say there's an infectious component to their symptoms, they tend to get like a fluoroquinolone or a macrolide, right? And then they tell you that, oh, this person starts having like these nasty, dangerous arrhythmias. You want to be super careful, right? They are likely suffering from like theophylline or toxicity on the exam, right? So don't forget those things. And then if for whatever reason they give you a question about a person that has like a bad asthma exacerbation in the emergency room, I mean, when they come in, you essentially need to give them like albuterol, like, you know, like a continuous like nebulizer, and then you give them like IV steroids, right? And typically when they're leaving the hospital, you need to give them like 3 to 4 days worth of like oral corticosteroids so that they don't have like a quick return of symptoms. You can also give like a dual nebulizer, right? Like you give a beta agonist like albuterol, and then a muscarinic antagonist, right? Ipratropium, right? You can give them combined. And then let's say you're giving everything and it's like, oh, this person is not getting better, you can give IV mag, like IV magnesium. And if a person is not like doing well, right? Because normally, in fact, let me take a step back here. During an asthma exacerbation, you should be hyperventilating, right? So your PCO2 should be low. If the PCO2 is beginning to normalize in a person that's undergoing an asthma exacerbation, there's bad news right there, right? That's why you obtain like routine, like regular EBGs on people going through like an asthma exacerbation or a COPD exacerbation. But especially asthma exacerbation, this is how they test it. You see the person's PCO2 is like 40 in an asthma exacerbation. That's bad news, right? It means the person's respiratory muscles are tiring out. Your next step is to go ahead and intubate that person like yesterday, right? If not, they'll crap out on you and die, you know, pretty quickly, right? So yeah, again, just keep all those things at the back of your mind with asthma. Again, COPD, I've kind of talked about like some of the testing. But again, COPD is going to be in a smoker, right? If you see a person less than the age of 45, even if they've smoked on an NBME with COPD, you want to begin to think about like an alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? And again, don't forget that, again, FEV1 to FVC less than 0.7, that's it. The person has obstructive lung disease. And if a person has emphysema as the cause of their COPD, the DLCO is going to be decreased, right? And again, if you see a person that has like multiple family members with COPD, that's very likely going to be alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency on your test, right? And there are some other things, right, that can cause obstructive lung disease that can give you a COPD-like picture. Like, for example, if they give you a question about a person that has, like, cystic fibrosis or cartilaginous syndrome, or a person has, like, you know, like, a ton of sputum production, like, they cough up a lot, like, super productive sputum. They have, like, episodes of hemoptysis. And they tell you that, oh, you see, like, these, like, linear streaks on a chest x-ray. Think about bronchiectasis. The way you ultimately make the diagnosis of bronchiectasis is with a high-resolution CT scan. You'll see, like, the tram track pattern of the person's bronchi on high-res CT. And then CF, again, CF is actually the most common cause of bronchiectasis in this country. I remember CF ultimately causes a restrictive kind of lung disease, not obstructive, restrictive kind of lung disease. But again, they may have bronchiectasis alongside with that. And again, obviously for cystic fibrosis, again, you do the sweat chloride test, right? And don't forget CF, right? Like they can have pneumonia on exams, right? If they're less than 20, right, it's Staph aureus that's causing it. You give them like the drugs that cover Staph aureus, right? Like vancomycin, especially like MRSA, right? Like Venc, linezolid, your tigecyclines. You can give ceftaroline, that's a fifth gen cephalosporin. You can give daptomycin, right? But if they're more than 20, it's probably Pseudomonas aeruginosa that's causing their pneumonia, right? So you want to give those drugs that cover Pseudomonas pneumonias, right? So like, you can give like a third gen cephalosporin ceftazidime, the fourth gen cephalosporin cefepime, right? Or you can give your carbapenems like meropenem, imipenem, doripenem, ertapenem. I know one of those penems though doesn't cover Pseudomonas, but I'm not gonna go into which one. That's step one. Further. Also, aztreonam, right, can cover Pseudomonas. Your fluoroquinolones can cover Pseudomonas, right? There's one more drug class I think I'm forgetting. Your aminoglycosides, right, can also cover Pseudomonas. In fact, for people that have cystic fibrosis, you can actually try to decrease their risk of like pulmonary infections by giving them inhaled tobramycin as prophylaxis. Remember, tobramycin is one of those aminoglycosides. So if a person has COPD, again, like I said, go ahead and start them on a short-acting beta agonist or a short-acting muscarinic antagonist. If they give you both as answer choices on a test, go with the short-acting muscarinic antagonist. Those are slightly preferred over the SABAs in a COPD management. And again, if that's not cutting it, if that's not controlling symptoms, then you just need to go ahead and add a LABA or a LAMA, right? A LABA is something like salmeterol, formoterol. A LAMA, so a long-acting muscarinic antagonist, is something like tiotropium, right? Tiotropium. I think that's what's called Spiriva in the hospital, right? And again, COPD, you know you're going to see COPD questions on your shelf, right? So you better pay attention to this part. And one thing I'll just go ahead and say, though, is never give a SAMA and a LAMA together. So a person should not be on ipratropium and tiotropium at the same time. To be honest with you, I really don't know why, but that's just one of those weird things that rarely shows up on exams. So if you showed up on an exam, almost everyone will get it wrong. But thankfully, you won't get it wrong because you paid attention to this podcast, right? And then indications for home oxygen therapy in COPD, right? You want to know those. Like if a person's p-AO2 is less than 55, or their O2 sats are less than 88%, or they have like polycythemia, right? You want to consider like if a person has like polycythemia, like their hematocrit is like crazy high. And remember, to go from hematocrit to hemoglobin, divide the hematocrit by 3, right? Or if they have like pulmonary hypertension or like signs of right-sided heart failure, those people certainly need a continuous home oxygen therapy. And you know, like the thing that has been, that's actually one of the things that have been shown to improve survival in COPD, continuous home O2 therapy. But the best intervention to improve survival in COPD is to, like stop smoking, right? So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And if a person comes in for a COPD exacerbation, right, and you know they're having trouble breathing, obviously you're going to give them like the short acting stuff. But in addition, you can place them, you don't just go straight to intubating those people, right? You usually try like BiPAP, right, before you intubate those folks. And the thing is, on your MBME exam, right, you know, they probably won't put BiPAP. That's too easy. Everyone will crush the exam if they did that. So instead of doing that, they may put like NIPPV as an answer, right? So like non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, right? That's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. So NIPPV, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. And typically, the antibiotic of choice in people that come in for COPD exacerbations on MBME exams is azithromycin, because apparently those macrolides also have like some anti-inflammatory properties. So that can help in a COPD exacerbation. And if a person, you know, has like end-stage COPD, you're like, yeah, this person is going to be dead soon. And, you know, they're having like severe shortness of breath. The drug of choice will actually be an opioid like morphine. It actually helps with shortness of breath. And again, those people, just like the asthma folks, you know, they need their annual influenza vaccine. They need the pneumococcal vaccine, right? And if a person has like alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, they need like IV, like pooled alpha-1 antitrypsin. That typically helps. And again, an exacerbation, right? You give them the short-acting stuff. You give them IV steroids. You can do the NIPPV. If they're not responding to NIPPV, then you intubate them. And then you also give them oral steroids to go home, right? So that, like, you know, like a 3 to 5 day course of oral corticosteroids. Okay. Now, I think I should probably consider like rounding up soon. But cystic fibrosis, I've already kind of talked about it, right? Like you'll be a person that has low weight. They may have a ton of nasal polyps, recurring sinusitis. They usually have finger clubbing. They may have fat malabsorption because remember, their pancreas is essentially dead, right? So that's why you typically have to do like pancreatic enzyme replacements in those people. Or they may have like diabetes, right? Because again, the pancreas is dead. So they have like an endocrine and an exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, right? So that's something to keep in mind on exams. And remember, cystic fibrosis is the most common cause of bronchiectasis in this country. And remember that if a person has a history of CF and then they have like sudden onset severe abdominal pain, you want to think about intussusception. That's actually one of those rare MBM exam causes of intussusception in adults, right? Think about an adult with cystic fibrosis, right? And again, what are the things you do for CF, right? You know, you just do things like, I've talked about the antibiotics you can use if they have like the staph aureus infections or whatever. And here's one thing, if a person has like really bad pneumonia and they're like pretty advanced cystic fibrosis, and let's say they don't put MRSA as an answer or Pseudomonas as an answer, think about this Burkholderia sepatia. So it's like Burk, like Burkholderia, Burkholderia sepatia, C-E-P-A-C-I-A, okay? And again, how do you treat CF? You know, you replace those pancreatic enzymes. You also need to supplement the fat-soluble vitamins, right? Because their pancreas doesn't work, right? They're not able, they'll have a fat malabsorption. So they won't be able to reabsorb fat-soluble vitamins like vitamins A, D, E, and K, right? You need to do chest physiotherapy for those folks. They may need like BiPAP or CPAP at night if they are like super hypoxemic at night. You can give them like Dornase alpha, like it's like a recombinant DNA. It breaks like phosphodiester bonds, so you can break up those secretions. Or you can give them like N-acetylcysteine, right? Remember, it breaks like disulfide bonds and all that stuff. So, you know, you can help them cough up that nasty goopy stuff in their lungs, right? So just, you know, kind of keep that at the back of your mind. And again, remember, it's sweat chloride testing that they use for that. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause it. I don't want this to be super long. As I do at the end of every podcast, offer one-on-one tutoring for a ton of exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3. Preclinical med school exams, 30-ish off exams. I actually tutor a ton of people for 30-ish off exams. And then I do this longitudinal tutoring where, unless you're studying off med school or you're studying off third year, and you know, I'll just tutor you for all your exams. And again, as I'm doing that, I'll be teaching you step 1 stuff or step 2 CK stuff alongside. And most of the people I've done that with, again, they've been wildly successful. And then I also offer these booster courses, like it's 15 hours for step 2 CK, step 3, it's 20 hours for step 1, where again, Q&A format, very rapid fire. And I also explain part of pathophysiology, like with, I talk about like the high yields, must knows for those tests. And then another thing that I also do is, it also is pretty good at helping like flush out whatever weaknesses you have, and then we deal with them. And then again, if you have like a problem in a specific subject, let's say like cardiology for step 2 CK or whatever, you can schedule like a 2-hour tutorial with me. I do it one-on-one. And basically after those 2 hours, that subject will not be a weakness for you on exams. I mean, like, it's really pretty striking when I hold those tutorials with people and you see them, like, they took a practice exam and they have like their MBMA like confidence bars all to the left for that subject. And then we do the tutorials, they take their next practice test, and for that subject is all the way up to the right. So those are usually like 2-hour tutorials. And then if you're a college student or an MCAT whatever person that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, offer tutoring for all those things. And then I also do like coaching or consulting for like, you know, if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, or a college student applying to med school, like an AMCAS app, like, you know, like rec letters, personal statements, mock interviews, editing applications. Again, I've worked with many specialties. The vast majority of people I've worked with have all matched at their first choice. And again, I have admissions committee experience at a top 2 med school. Like, I was literally on the admissions committee. So again, if you need advising with any of those things, or if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for like the internal medicine board exams, the internal medicine in-train exam, feel free to reach out to me. And if you're like a PEDS resident, I need tutoring for the in-training exam for PEDS or the PEDS boards, reach out to me as well. I'll probably start doing like mainstream tutoring for the surgery boards in the future. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you for listening to me, and I will continue POM critical care in the next, in another Family Medicine podcast. So thank you for listening. God bless you. I'll see you next time.